So we move on to part three of the book of Deuteronomy, which is the central section. It's not the most beautiful section, although it has beautiful parts in it, but it's really the core of the book of Deuteronomy, and it's legal material covering the whole social and ritual life of the community, and it's from Deuteronomy 12 to 25. We've kind of introduced it in the whole book and the whole Deuteronomic history. Then we looked at the 10 words at great depth, or as depth as I could. Then we've got the lovely introduction for this statutes and edicts. So it's, the book's gone through a lot of processes, and now we move to these chapters. And the Deuteronomists have spent 11 chapters preparing us for these edicts, statutes and edicts, as distinct from words, which applies to the Ten Commandments. The situation in Israel, which led to the collapse of the Northern Kingdom in 721 BC, and the similar threat facing Judah in the 7th century, when it was always under Assyrian, was like a vassal state of Assyria, led them to the conviction that their only hope of survival is as a people lay in radical reform. Why did they go wrong in the Northern Kingdom? Well, the Deuteronomists were already writing at that time, I think, the beginnings, and they were lining up with Amos and Hosea and criticising the political, and it got nowhere. They came south with the refugees, and in Jerusalem they had a king that was kind of open to them, Hezekiah, but when he died, his son Manasseh bought into the system, which is totally understandable, because it was either that or be destroyed, probably. So he bought into the Assyrian thing, and he was there for a long time, and the place deteriorated, and the Deuteronomists went underground, still worked, but they were hoping for the day when they could actually form a people that was obedient to God's will. So they're looking in the light of Yahwism, which is their spirit. How should we live here? How should we live there? What should we do here, etc.? And they're getting this material together. Then Josiah comes as king, their favourite, and his law, their laws, the Deuteronomist laws, are put into practice by the king, which is remarkable. And if you read the books of the kings and the story of Josiah the king, and read the Deuteronomic edicts we're about to do here, there's a very close parallel. So they're clearly linked. Then, however, Jerusalem was destroyed. And they go into exile, and they're still doing what we're always doing. We're doing it in a lot of things these days. You know, how do we hand on the faith to our children in this new scene, which is totally unlike any situation the world's ever known? The colossal change of changes that have occurred in people's lives, the World Wide Web, to use that as an one word to cover the whole globalization of the world, the information overload, all that, immediate texting. You know, how do you reach the text generation, which is, you know, the 14, 15, 16-year-olds? How do you get to them in a way that you go, you know, get their attention long enough away from the iPod to actually pay some attention, or the mobile phone? So we're asking these questions all the time. So were they in their own different world. So the radical reform, we're about to look at some of the laws. So laws had to be put in place to ensure fidelity to the covenant with Yahweh, and to strengthen institutions in the community that would support the kind of relationships within the community that the covenant required. So the covenant is the key. Communion with God, it's what we're all about, all of us still. How do we have the full communion with God where we live and live to the full as a people? So that's their key. Now, so you need this and you need that. How should the king behave? We'll see it in about half an hour's time. How should the law, the administration of justice, what should the prophets be doing, etc.? And what should we do as a community? Reform involves a change of attitude, but it must be supported by practical changes of behaviour. We've come to the central section of Deuteronomy in which these reforms are spelt out. We've done a lot in the first four chapters, and in last week, about the attitudes, about covenant with God, about love, about do not put the Lord your God to the test. We've done a lot of that basic spiritual work that the Deuteronomists were hoping to bring about. Now we need to have a look at the practical reforms. The Deuteronomists were convinced that these reforms were consistent with the central ideas of Mosaic, Moses, Yahwism. And these reforms were needed if the people were going to be faithful to the covenant. And so they're presented to the people as Moses' testament to the people as they're about to begin life in the promised land. If I were the general of the Jesuits, well, you never know. Unlikely at this stage of my life, because I'm not a Jesuit, and I'd be more like a corporal, I think, than a general. But anyhow, were I the general of the Jesuits, can you imagine facing half the Jesuits? The Jesuits are half as big now as they were 50 years ago. Still a whopping big order, but they're aging like me, and like you, some of you. And so, if I were the general, and I were to, for example, want to write to my fellow Jesuits throughout the world, and this is what the generals do, to try and inspire them with a way of social justice and how to... They're asking the same questions mums and dads are asking and not finding the answers much better than you, but we're all in this together. So they're trying, and I'm the general, and I'm trying to. Can't you imagine me... I can't imagine me anyhow. I can imagine myself writing a letter to you, the testament of Ignatius of Loyola. And what I would put in it would be stuff you would recognise. I'm not saying Ignatius of Loyola wrote the bloomin' thing back in the 16th century, but I'm saying this is what Ignatius of Loyola would say today to us Jesuits in the light of the spirit that he had, the convictions that he had, which we've all brought up in the novitiate, we all know them, that I would be applying, wouldn't I, the insights of Ignatius of Loyola to today's 21st century world. And I could write it in the form of the Testament of Ignatius of Loyola. You're all Jesuits. You read it and you say, oh, no, he's missed the point. I mean, we elected him general. Somebody elected him. I didn't elect him, but somebody elected him general. And he really hasn't got... So I'd write back to the general and say, look, you know, you're going off on a tangent. That's not really what he was about. Do you get it? You'd come in and do something about it. So you've got to imagine that going on all the time in their world, in the 8th century, 7th century, 6th century world, that they're debating with each other. What was Moses? What is our faith honestly really about? And what we've got here is the conclusions of this school, now fixed in writing, kind of locked in, but not at the time we're talking now, but it got into the Bible and then got fixed, and that's a bit of a problem, but anyhow, that happened. But can't you imagine that happening? Do you feel all right about that? Just because it has, and Moses said to them, Ignatius said to them, but the words aren't the words of Ignatius, because he didn't speak English and he didn't speak words of today, and he uses words that didn't exist in the 16th century in what I'm writing to you. But you know, you might say, yes, he's really got Ignatius' spirit. And we end up having a convention or something, and all the Jesuits get together and we produce a document for the 21st century from all of us. And that's the thing, and it's really Ignatian stuff. Or Francis of Assisi, who didn't write much, he wrote some things, but hardly. But, you know, I hope you get my point. So that's what we're reading. Don't be worried that, oh, it says that Moses said it, so Moses must have said it. I mean, clear out your brain a bit and get your right brain working and get into the literature of the day. So, they're convinced, they're presenting this as Moses' testament, which means the essence of our faith as it came from the beginning. That's what that means. They've taken 11 chapters to prepare us to listen to these statutes and edicts because they will achieve reform only if they're carried out in the right spirit. They're going to give us the list of rules now, but what's the spirit behind them? Chapters 1 to 11 is all about that. They were must be lived from the heart. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and mind and soul and strength. We read that last week. And it must be an exclusive allegiance to Yahweh. Don't get caught up in the gods of Babylon. They look powerful. Babylon's the big empire and they've got all this rubbish religion stuff and you might think it's worth it, or don't think you have to start a bank somewhere. No, wait a minute. Get to the heart of your faith. Right. Some of these statutes and edicts repeat material from older codes, especially the covenant code. Now, unless you've bought my commentary and can do your homework at home, I don't know. You can't do this here, really. But if you look up the ancient covenant code, which we'll do in the next series when I do Exodus with you, there are parallels here. And that's really ancient. How do they know it's ancient? Because it's got laws in it that apply to the patriarchal period, not the patriarchal period, the period of the tribal. It applies to a very much, just as you could tell if you saw a law book and they had certain laws in it, you'd say that was really pre-industrial Britain. That was the law in Ireland in the 8th century when, you know, you can tell by the look of the law. So you can tell in this Deuteronomic book, they're keeping everything. They're keeping the ancient stuff so it's not forgotten. They're keeping more modern, up-to-date stuff, and they're applying it to their present situation too. So it's an amalgam of stuff. Inspired by God? Well, it's a big topic, inspiration, but it just means it's come out of the prayerful debate and discussion and of religious men, they would have been. Their wives might have given them a few clues at home, but the blokes were there doing the writing and all that kind of thing. Now, the covenant code is in Exodus 20:22 to 23:33, and you'll see some parallels if you were to study it. Some of the statutes and edicts we're about to do today was composed prior to the reign of Josiah. And that can be told by looking at them and carefully studying them. And that's, in other words, the second half of the 7th century. Much of it comes from his time, from the time of Josiah, and was composed to support his reform. The group that got in power when Josiah became king, the Deuteronomists, had the ear of the emperor. So they together worked out reforms, what they're going to do. They're only going to have one central sanctuary, Jerusalem, because there were problems over there and problems over there and problems over there. So if you centralise it, you can get more control over the ritual, you know. But that had massive problems because some of the older laws, they demanded that you go to the sanctuary at certain days during the year. That was all right when the sanctuary was just over the road or 5 kilometres away and every little group had their own sanctuary. Do you get it? Once you centralise the sanctuary, you can't have a law like that because it's not going to work. You can't come from Dan right down to Jerusalem in a few hours and offer sacrifices and go back home. So the laws have to change, and they do change, and they have pilgrimage feasts being shifted to the autumn instead of the winter, and the after the season instead of before the season, and students, and you could be one if you had the time, can go through all this and notice all this, which you don't read if you just open the book. It's confusing just opening the book. I hope I don't confuse you today. Don't want to in here. So parts of these chapters we're going to do today belong to the exilic period and some of them to post-exilic period. And the final touches are probably as late as the second half of the 5th century BC. So, are you with me? And I'm not going to be certain about all this. I'm giving you the best information I can give you from my own study, and what else can I do? So, there'll be arguments about certain verses by different scholars, and there's PhDs written all over it, and where I do my study is at the Biblicum University in Rome, which is the whole university is about the Bible, so every book's written there. They've even got my books in it, so they're desperate. No, you've got most stuff is in the library available, so you can imagine it's all available to be read. If you wouldn't be allowed in, I'm sorry to tell you, and because they can't have everybody there. You have to kind of know somebody who knows somebody who have done a course there to do it. And you can't borrow, even I can't borrow library, books from that library. You have to study them in the library itself. But you can go along the shelves and pick them out, which is great. You don't have to ask somebody to go and find it for you and wait a day till it comes back, which you have to do in many libraries. All right. Some of the texts express principles which were meant to transcend particular situations, general principles. Other texts specifically geared to the practicalities prevailing at the time, and that's what law has to do. This means that the individual pieces of legislation aren't always consistent. A specific law for pre-agrarian whatever is not going to be the same as a specific law at the time of Josiah, when everything's different. So, as in all the other biblical codes, older and newer legislation exist side by side. And that's really good. They didn't just update it and forget the old and select what they liked. They tried to keep their whole tradition intact. The statutes and edicts aim to ensure that every aspect of the life of the community is governed by the covenant that Israel has with Yahweh. The Deuteronomists were interested in reforming their contemporary situation, of course, not wasting their time talking to nobody or talking to people who died 300 years ago. They're interested in their present situation. The Deuteronomists are interested in that. The precise details may well have no relevance in a different time and a different situation. To appreciate their significance, we need to place ourselves in Judah during the time of Manasseh. Imagine yourself as in a messy situation and where you're dominated by Assyria, and you go to the temple and there's a statue of Ashur there, not of Yahweh. Well, there's no statues of Yahweh, but it's all mucked up. But you're a religious person, so you're a religious Christian living in communist Russia when you're not allowed to, you know, go public with worship and all that. How do you carry on your faith? How do you give it to your kids when they're learning all this stuff from their school? It's atheistic, you know, that kind of thing. So there, you've got to put yourself in their situation. Or in the time of Josiah, when you're hoping to regain the whole of the promised land, or among the exiles, or among the returned exiles, determined not to repeat the sins of their forebears. We will observe the cultural blind spots that inhere in the legislation, the human beings, for heaven's sake. And while they're responding as prayerfully as they can to the mystery of God, you can respond as prayerfully as you want to the mystery of God and come up with some rubbish. I probably wouldn't. You know what I mean? We all can. You can only talk from where you are, and you look back late, and I suppose if someone recorded homilies I gave on marriage when I was 24 and newly ordained priest, I might look at it and think, oh my God, did I say that? Because you can only see, and you hope that the people have got enough sense to think, oh well, yes, he's a celibate and he's a male, so I don't, you know, take too much notice of him. There's no need to nod, all you women. But yeah, he's doing his best for a young fella or for a doddery old bloke. But so we'll have to pick out some of the inherent limitations, and we've got such an advantage in doing that, as long as we do it humbly and carefully. We've got Jesus saying, it was said to you of old, but I say to you. We've got to check everything in the book of Deuteronomy by Jesus. But it would be surprising if there were not equivalent reforms that we should institute to achieve the same goals in the same spirit. For we're no less threatened by the unconverted values of our environment and by our own dysfunctional personal and communal desires than were the people of Judah in all those years ago. Our problem, I think, different from theirs, and probably new, or new meaning since the Reformation, I'd say, which means since the Enlightenment, since that kind of, and so much good came out of all that, but I think one of the negatives that came out of it was faith became a bit of a private thing. It's between me and God. And you've got to be so careful. We invited two women up from Sydney to talk to... You were all welcomed. I hope you heard about it. If you didn't, well, we just keep trying. On music and the liturgy and that kind of thing. And we invited two of them. And we had a whole day last Saturday at it. But only 23 people came, which cost us a bit of a fortune because it cost $2,000 to put it on. So we're short of money, but we're a rich parish, Kippax, Holt. You know, we're in one of the economically more poorer areas. And I'm not asking for money for this, by the way. But I'm just saying that's what happened. Only 23 people came. I thought, what a shame. One from Yass, one from Cooma, one from Young, one from somewhere else I've forgotten, and a few from other places. So our parish itself, and you can imagine how I enthused people to come. Did we have five, I think? Six? Something like that. I'm not, by the way, criticising anyone for that, because you've got your life to live. But I'm just saying, okay. And why did I even say that? Oh, yeah. Because one of the key speakers at it was saying, Hillsong asked her, because she's right up in front in this business, why are so few Hillsong music sung in Catholic churches? They couldn't understand because they're popular. And she said, my question is, why are any of them sung?
Yes.
And her reason for asking that question was, basically they're about me and God and personal salvation. Not all, they're starting to learn a bit, but it's a lot of it is really not Catholic theology. So they're exciting and the kids get excited and it's Jesus is my Lord and my Saviour, good show, great. But the Catholic thing is all about we. It's about us. It's about the body. It's about the family. Do you know what I mean? It's essentially like that. So we can't just have popular music churning out. It has to be theologically really sound we could take our kids into, if they want exciting music, you're never going to do it as well in church as they can get it elsewhere. So don't compete. You're not going to do it because they'd get much more, don't they, quickly off their thing, walking through all the music and that. So we're not going to be able to do that. What are we doing? This is my take on it. We're trying to provide an environment where they will have an experience that they can't get anywhere else. And it will be a lot to do with a young person's accessing it, but it'll have to be doing with prayer, silence, love, the mystical. It'll have to be something like that. And you don't have to have music that a Gregorian chant that I would love. You're not going to say, though, that wouldn't hurt either. Somehow we've got to do, and I presume I got onto that by this, they're trying to get laws. We have to find ways today of building a community that invites people into, that's why at schools, for example, if teachers do it, often the children love the quiet. They love the silence. They love the mantra because they never have it anywhere else. It's all zim, zim, blah, blah, boo, boo, you know, text, answer, chat room. I'm not exaggerating. I am exaggerating probably. But it's very busy stuff. But their soul, your soul, their souls aren't a lot different from mine or yours. They want something, like a little baby looking into its mother's eyes. They want something that's at another level of their being. And somehow we've got to do that. So back to Deuteronomy. They wanted to ensure... So we're going to observe the cultural blind spots, but it'd be surprising if there wasn't something we can learn from them for today in our very, very different situation. So with that having been said, we now launch into the statutes and ordinances of this section. The first section is about proper worship. So appropriately, just as the Ten Commandments, 10 words, start with God, because if we get God wrong, everything's wrong. So we have to somehow, and we have to get a modern understanding, your image of God has to be relevant to an expanding universe, which I didn't know about when I was a young boy. Now, the massive stuff that's come through astronomy, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So any image of God that bypasses all that is not worth a crap, not worth anything. So we've got to kind of hold all that. So the first thing they do is proper worship. Well, the first thing, which I won't read, is about demolishing pagan altars. Get rid of all your pagan altars. The next thing is about centralizing the religious cult. And here we are at the heart of Deuteronomy. Hezekiah tried it. Josiah tried it. And of course, once Judah is the only tribe that's actually effectively existing, it's easier to do, because their cult center becomes the center for everything. But there's not much more than Judah to do it anyhow. So here's the text, chapter 12, verse 5 to 32. I'll just take one little sentence out of it. You shall eat there in the presence of Yahweh your God, you and your households together, rejoicing in all your undertakings in which Yahweh your God has blessed you. There, meaning in the place appointed by God. Brackets, read, Jerusalem temple. 12:15 reads, whenever you desire, you may slaughter and eat meat within any of your towns. Now that might strike you as, yeah, so what? Except if you read Leviticus chapter 17, 3 to 7, you'll find that you can only kill domesticated animals, sheep, cattle. You can only kill them as a sacrifice and only in the sanctuary. So there's actually a contradiction between these two laws. And I've already given you the reason why. When Leviticus is covering, reimagining a period when there are cult centres through all the tribal areas, Shechem, Dan, Hebron, Beersheba, and I could go on and on, I don't need to. So that demanded you could easily go to a sanctuary. So it was a control on bloodlust, really. It was a control on just going out and shooting and killing animals for the fun of it, which probably they had the same silly urge that some human beings seem to have, to just kill animals for fun or sport. No, they had to bring them into the sanctuary. So it was a reminding them that blood is sacred, life is sacred. And yes, you can eat them, but it's pretty restricted, you know. Carefully ritualized. You can't do it once you've only got one center. So here comes a law which updates the ancient law, 12:15. Whenever you desire, you may slaughter and eat meat within any of your towns. It's not saying go for some slather, but it's making the thing realistic in a different situation. Am I being clear? 12:16. The blood, however, you must not eat. You shall pour it out on the ground like water. And that's got a lot to do with kosher food still in the Jewish world, because blood strangled animals, where the blood dries up inside the rabbit, you can't eat it. You can't touch it. It has to be the living animal. The blood has to be all poured out, and then you go through a process of purification and so on. Why? It's reminding people that blood is sacred means it's life, it's from God. You just can't kill and eat. You're constantly reminded of the sacred when you go through the care of cooking food. You can't do it without thinking of God, and God is the life giver and so on. It's actually quite a beautiful thing. But there's the law to cover it in a new situation. Chapter 13, verses 1 to 5, is about prophecy, because that's a problem, prophecy. It still is. You get some medieval mystic somewhere up on the Rhine River, has all these visions of Mary or somebody, usually Mary, and they write all this stuff and all their prayer, and you've got to watch it, because some of it could be psychedelic kind of brain stuff. Some of it may be really pure and beautiful, but I don't know. I think I'll wait till the church approves of it, really, because there's so much good stuff to read already. But there are some people who hook on to this stuff, and they know there's one. I don't want to mention names at all because it wouldn't be appropriate, but there's somebody who tells you all the background to Jesus' life. Is it Faustina? Anyhow, whatever it is, there's books written everything Jesus did and everything he thought and all that's in behind the gospel, I think that is so dangerous. It's like watching a television program that stops you instead of reading a book. It's like watching the Lord of the Rings on the big screen, or reading the Lord of the Rings. And, you know, the media is so different. And surely the reading is so much better. Because in the reading one, you have to supply the pictures. You have to create the images. You have to feel your way into what's going on. There, it's all given to you, and it's exciting, and it's all there. And they did a marvellous job, I have to say, I think, because I saw both, read it and saw it. And I think, gee, they did such a good job. But, oh, dear, I reckon my images of the Hobbits was much better than... Well, you can't do it over there. Do you know what I'm saying, don't you? So the reading is so important. Well, what about all this stuff that's filling in? Stay with the gospel and stay with what we know. Don't dream other people's dreams and let it come in and clog up your imagination. That'd be my little advice. But there are some people who are absolutely the opposite to me on that, and good... I won't say good luck to them. They don't get anywhere with me anyhow. But when they come into the church and want to foust it on everybody, I just go into the thing and take it off the shelf and put it in the rubbish bin. I mean, basically, that's what I do. So if you're keen on all this stuff, don't please bring it to Kipex, because it will go into the bin. Only because read the gospel. Read. Okay, enough. So prophecy is a problem for me too, obviously. If I think I'm trying to give you the truth as best I see it, but you're all wary of me, I hope. You should be. And only listen to the echo in you that makes sense in the light of your life experience. You know I'm honest and you know I'm doing my best. But honest, I think Hitler might have been honest and doing his best. And enthusiastic, genuine, very genuine person. Idi Amin was probably a really good country boy who wanted the best for his country. But holy smoke. So, all right, that's the introduction. Now listen to Deuteronomy on the prophets, which is actually quite relevant to something I'll mention in a minute. If I think this is why Jesus was crucified, by the way, this text. This is the justification for the crucifying of Jesus in the minds of those who did it. If prophets or those who divine by dreams, read mystics, if they're not carefully vetted, appear among you and promise you omens or portents, miracles, and the omens or portents declared by them take place, so they go, you go to the Philippine Islands or somewhere, or I don't know, Kipax Parish, and someone puts their hand in and goes, and pulls out something, and your liver's healed, and you're happy, you're well. You might be well because you stopped drinking last year. But anyhow, whatever about that, and I don't want to knock it. So the saying, the portents actually come about and they say, let us follow other gods, brackets, gods whom you have not known, not Yahweh, not the God of the poor, not the God who hears the cry of the widow, but the God of success. Wake up in the morning, tune into an American station and get a televangelist thundering the truth to you. And if you're not a millionaire by the time you've finished, don't know what you've been listening to. So you've got to be so careful, haven't you? What God are we following? So, and they let us follow other gods and let us serve them. You must not heed the words of these prophets or those who divine by dreams. These prophets and those who divine by dreams will be put to death for having spoken treason against Yahweh your God. Be Paul of Tarsus. I'll go back a bit, but be Paul. Be a Pharisee. Be an absolutely brilliant young man brought up by Gamaliel, the greatest teacher of the day, and so aware of the Torah, and so keen, and so obedient, and so law-abiding, and then he sees all these blooming Christians who are saying that God is revealed to them through this bloke whom the high priest organized to be crucified. He's a Galilean for a start, and he also broke the Torah. again and again and again. He ate with sinners. He said to a woman in adultery, I do not condemn you. Holy, what's going to happen if that kind of talk gets around? And so on and so on and so on. Can't you see them seeing Jesus as he's got the wrong God? Go back a bit. Go to the people who condemn Jesus, the high priest who rent his garments. Even see him at his best, the high priest and the rest of them. He must die because he said, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will build it up. And he's claiming some kind of communion with God, but he's obviously, he doesn't even speak the proper English, the proper Hebrew. He's up there from Galilee with a bit of an accent. And when Jesus said, gor blimey gov, they thought, oh, Lord, where did he go to school? And so on. But you get, all that would have been, that's all part of it, don't worry. He had a Cockney accent or the equivalent. See, so, or a South American, Southern States American drawl. But they would have seen Jesus. Can't you see how that would justify them? Yes, he brought about things that were real. He did heal people. But as Jesus himself says, your Pharisees heal people too. Healing people isn't, it's whatever it is, it's complex, but it's not necessarily a sign of God's presence. So we can get caught up in all this stuff as well. And they're saying, no, he must be put to death. So I think that is the justification they had for crucifying Jesus. Oh. Do not let anyone else seduce you to idolatry. Idolatry is worshipping a false god. And since 3/4 of the world is doing it, I presume I am too, and you are too probably, just be careful. It's likely, because all our gods are actually wrong. I mean, didn't Thomas Aquinas say that? What we say about God is more wrong than right. So we've got to keep correcting it and nurturing it and maturing it and checking it, and we never get it right. But we've got to keep reforming our thoughts about God, and ultimately being a saint is the only way you'll ever know, in love. So idolatry is pretty common. The pagan cult of the dead is forbidden in Deuteronomy 14. Then there's a list of what can and can't be eaten. The kosher, if you could use that word, all the stuff that can be eaten. And here's just briefly, in my book I've done it much more detail, but this is my attempt to give you the key insight, as far as I'm able to, into why certain foods were edible and why they weren't. Because it looks a bit random if you just don't know the culture. The key is that some aspect of the proscribed animals, proscribed meaning not allowed to do it, the animals, fish, birds and insects, there's an aspect of them that associates them symbolically with death. The hoped for result of this, it's actually quite beautiful. The hoped for result of people, you can't eat that and you can't eat that and you can eat this, having to make that discernment each time, is that in avoiding food, people would be reminded to choose life. Meaning communion with God. I don't think it did us any harm, by the way, when we, as a group, we didn't eat meat on Friday. It didn't do us any harm at all. I can't think of what harm it did, because it reminded us every time it's Friday, we can't have a meat pie, or, you know, you were polite about it if you were invited out. But on the whole, that's what Catholics did, and that didn't do. That was a reminder, wasn't it, that this is a special day. And when we did fasting, and now Vatican II treated me as an adult before I was an adult. So it left me free and said, it says fast on Fridays, but you choose the fast. Do I fast on Fridays? No. And I'm a priest. So if I asked you to put your hands up, who actually fasts on Friday? Some of you would put your hand up, I imagine. Some of you mature people, but most of you might be like me. It's just another day in the week. And it is just another day in the week. But what I've lost, what the community's lost, is an identifying thing that faces us towards Friday is the day of the Passion. You know, we So we need reminders. We're not just spiritual beings. So that's, I think, the key. Oh, we can't eat that. No, we don't eat that because it's something to do with death. That's the key. I think you'll find that. So in other words, when you choose your food carefully, they mightn't be doing this, by the way. The people who are following the food, they might be just a habit. When I didn't eat meat on Friday, I may not have thought of the passion of Jesus. It's possible. And so the church was trying to internalize the stuff among us. And what a good thing to try to do. There's a thing about tithing in chapter 14, 22 to 29. Tithe is a tenth of your produce given, etc. Now, a few changes here. In Leviticus 27, 30 to 33, which I won't be studying with you, but the tithe goes to the support of the temple, including the priests. Who wrote Leviticus? The priests. Oh, how dare you laugh? So who writes it is quite critical. In the later legislation in Numbers 18, 21 to 32, the tithe is set aside for the support of the Levites. I wonder who wrote Numbers. Here in Deuteronomy, the tithe is brought to the sanctuary as an acknowledgement of Yahweh, but then it's eaten in a community meal. It's actually quite remarkable advance. Much more mature legislation than you find in either Numbers, which is the last of the works, or the book of Deuteronomy. But it's also dealing with the change situation too. The temple is becoming less and less important as well, and the priestly caste isn't so important. So I'm only giving you that as a quick example of how law necessarily changes. But it's also taking to the heart of Deuteronomy's key insight. Of most interest in the legislation, that every third year the tithe has to be spent on the poor. So it's the beginnings of social legislation. I'll read you the text. It's chapter 14, 28 to 29. Every third year you shall bring out of the full tithe of your produce for that year and store it within your towns. The Levites, as well as the resident aliens, the orphans and the widows in your towns, may come and eat their fill, so that Yahweh your God may bless you in all that you undertake. The Levites were among the poorest people, by the way, because they were the priestly people that came from other sanctuaries and never got a job at the temple because they already had their priests. So they were priests who didn't own land and lost their job and were among the unemployed, nearly. So they were considered among the poor. And you can see there's the text. Resident aliens, orphans and widows. So it was their taking up the collection on Sunday for the Vincent de Paul and the poor. Every seventh year, debt had to be finished. A massively problematic law which never worked. Didn't work because the sabbatical year, you know, the seventh year, debt's finished. Okay. It's year six. And you come along to me, you're desperate, and you come along to me for a loan. Am I likely to give you a loan? If in 2 months' time the debt is, I'll be thinking, oh, sorry, you know, I wish I could help, but I've actually got, my little kids have got to buying a house sale somewhere. So it actually got in the road, this law. It was an ideal that never actually worked because it didn't work. It disincentivized giving to the poor or lending to people in a particular situation. A seventh thing was that they must free Hebrew slaves in the seventh year. And weren't supposed to have Hebrew slaves. But it happened. Usually when you read a law, same with canon law, take the law of celibacy. From about the 8th century to the 12th century, every blooming council said priests should not marry. Well, if you said it once and you're saying it every 2 months all over Spain and France and England and everywhere else, do you know what's happening? They're not taking any notice of the law. So you have to keep repeating it. Otherwise, if everyone's obeying it, why would you bother? So here, they have to free Hebrew slaves in the seventh year. Here's the text. Chapter 15:15. Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Yahweh, your God, redeemed you. So what are you doing having slaves? And the best they could try and control it was after 7 years you had to let the slave be free. Only this version gives female slaves the same rights as male slaves. If you look at 15 verse 17 of Deuteronomy, and if you compare it with Exodus 21, the rights of the male, not the female. So there's been a bit of advance there as well. Consecrating the firstborn male of the livestock. In Deuteronomy 15, you shall eat it, you together with your household. And this differs from the priestly version in Numbers 18, when it's eaten by the priests. So if you're going to be a fundamentalist, you'd actually, if you're intelligent and you're a fundamentalist, your brain would have to collapse, if you're honest. Because you can't have it both ways, you know what I mean? So you've got to think historically to make any sense of any of this. And realise it's not a contradiction, it's a reapplication of a principle in a different situation. Or another point of view on it by a different group within the community. Number 9, the festival of the Pasch and the pilgrimage festival, which is called a Hajj. What do the Muslims call their Hajj? Same word, see? A Hajj is a pilgrimage festival in Hebrew. Hajj is the Arabic from that word. Of unleavened bread. Leaven brings out fermentation and is associated with corruption. Because if you've got leaven, if you haven't got leaven in the bread, it can last nearly forever. Not quite, but nearly forever. And if you have yeast in it, it'll soon get all mouldy and things, it'll corrupt. So it's the association again with death that accounts for the unleavened nature of the bread. There's another pilgrimage festival of weeks. I'll give it to you in a minute. It's called the Festival of Weeks in Deuteronomy. With the centralization of worship, it was necessary to wait the end of the harvest. The harvest began with Passover, Pasch, the barley harvest. So they celebrated that. Now, they had to wait 7 weeks, which means 50 days, Greek pentekonta, Pentecost, 50 days after, for a pilgrimage to be possible. Whereas earlier law had them doing it at the beginning, in the middle of all that. But they couldn't do it anymore because they had to get the harvest in. So realistically, they changed the law. God changed the law, sorry. Moses changed the law to fit in. It became a celebration of thanksgiving for the harvest. And because it was 7 weeks after the celebration of Exodus, judging from post-biblical evidence, it was linked with the giving of the Torah on Mount Horeb. And so the Christian community, because, you know, it took them roughly 7 lots of 7, symbolic, to get from Egypt, the Passover, to Mount Sinai. Do you get it? So that's the So Pentecost started to be associated with the giving of the Torah. New Testament, Luke associates these various feasts too. So he has the Holy Spirit coming, the new Torah, the new covenant, poured out on the 50th day, the 7 sevens plus one. So the symbolism is all intact and quite beautiful, but we're not dealing with empirical data. We're dealing with imagination and religious perception. Once again, they call for special care for slaves and Levites, strangers, orphans, and widows. So that's at the heart of the book of Deuteronomy. Then the third pilgrimage is a pilgrimage festival of booths, or tabernacles is the word we use. Tabernacle or booth. Sukkot in Hebrew. And that's in Deuteronomy. So these are the three big pilgrimage festivals. They're not just festivals. They're... Now, it takes place at the end of the agricultural year. Autumn. The people are awaiting the autumn rains to soften the earth and get ready for the sowing and so on. This creates the perfect circumstance for a seven-day pilgrimage to the sanctuary because there's nothing to do. It's winter, you don't need to mow the lawns because there aren't any. Got it? So they're able to go off and do a festival for 7 days. Now, in all likelihood, the name Booths comes from the fact that a huge influx of pilgrims to the sanctuary required the setting up of temporary dwellings to accommodate them for a stay of 7 days. So there were tents out in around Jerusalem, down in the valley and up the hill, and they're the booths, so it gets this name, Booths. Rejoice, set to 16 verse 14, during your festival. They're about joy. You and your sons and your daughters, your male and female slaves, don't leave them at home doing work, bring them with you. And the Levites, the strangers, the orphans and the widows resident in your towns. Everyone's got to have this 7 day off to celebrate and to worship God. The focus of the statutes and edicts to this point, up to where we are now, has been on total allegiance to Yahweh and the way in which this is to be expressed in the cult. The Deuteronomists now turn, and I'll begin it, I'll stop as soon as the noise out there gets unbearable, but I'll keep going so that we can, there's a lot of people talking soon out there, so I'll just keep going till I can get a break. The Deuteronomists now turn to the way in which a community in a special covenant relationship with Yahweh is to be ordered. They're the things they've got to do. How do you order the community? They begin with the administration of justice. Then they speak about the king, the priests, and the prophets. So they go through the key institutional bodies that govern the community. And I'll do it with you, obviously, quickly. Administration of Justice, chapter 16, verse 18 to 20, reads, "You shall appoint judges and officials throughout your tribes, in all your towns that Yahweh your God is giving you, and they shall render just decisions for the people. You must not distort justice. You must not show partiality. You must not accept bribes. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and subverts the cause of those who are in the right. Own justice and only justice you shall pursue so that you may live and occupy the land that Yahweh your God is giving you." Pretty good principle. Another fact of justice is this need for two witnesses. This comes into the New Testament as well. You might remember in the trial of Jesus, two witnesses got up and said, he said, destroy this temple, and the high priest says, what more need do we, etc. Deuteronomy chapter 17, 2-7. "If there is found among you a man or woman who transgresses Yahweh's covenant by going to serve other gods and worshipping them, and if it's reported to you or you hear of it, and you make a thorough inquiry, and the charges prove true that such an abhorrent thing has occurred in Israel, then you shall bring out to the gates that man or that woman who has committed this crime, and you shall stone the man or woman to death." There's no freedom of religion in this world, and there still isn't in some cultures. On the evidence, and they couldn't afford it because their community, this was at the basis of, it's like treason. So the basis of their communal understanding. On the evidence of two or three witnesses, the death sentence shall be executed. A person must not be put to death on the evidence of only one witness. Sensible. The hands of the witness shall be the first raised against the person to execute to death. So you can't give a false witness and then buy out of it. You have to be the one to stone them. So that put your money where your mouth is kind of stuff. to execute the death penalty afterwards the hands of all the people, so you shall purge the evil from your midst. That's judgment. Now, the king, what's he got to do? It's quite lovely, quite important. The king mustn't acquire many horses. You know why, don't you? A horse was not for horse races. The horse was the tank of the day, was the F-111 of the day. The horses were the battle tool. So it's about war. And he must not acquire many wives for himself. Solomon, eat your heart out. Or else his heart will turn away. Also, silver and gold he must not acquire in great quantity for himself. They should write this into the law system of every country. Now, here we've got a little interesting point. He shall have a copy of this law. Hebrew, Mishneh HaTorah. Greek, Deuteronomion. Deutero, second, copy. Nomos, law. That's where the title for the book comes from. Deuteronomy, from that verse. It only comes once there, that's it. And the Mishnah, you may have heard of the Mishnah, which is not related to this now. It's a later document of the Jewish world. It means copy. So he shall, the king, will have a copy of the Torah, a Deuteronomion. Copy of the Torah, written for him in the presence of the Levitical priests. It shall remain with him. He shall read in it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to fear Yahweh his God, diligently observing all the words of this Torah. The words equals Ten Commandments. And these statutes, which we've just been through, neither exalting himself above other members of the community, nor turning aside from the commandment, so that he and his descendants may reign long over the kingdom of Israel. And then, just to do it, the priests. Regulations concerning priests, chapter 18, 12 and the following. These regulations differ from the regulations written by the priestly school. In the Deuteronomists allow any one of the tribe of Israel to minister as a priest. There's quite a debate. In fact, there's a struggle going on during the exile and immediately after the exile. One group of priests won the struggle. And so the other groups of priests were reduced to being Levites, and they were like sacristans. But they weren't actually the ones to offer sacrifice. This battle is going on. And when you look at the text, you see the book of Leviticus, inspired by God, written by Moses, are you with me? Says one thing, book of Deuteronomy says another. So you don't have to be a sleuth or, what's her name, Marple or something?
Miss Marple,
to work out that there's something sniffy going on here. Both the collapse of Israel and the centralization of the cult had a dramatic effect on the Levites, clearly. Intimately connected to the cult as they are, the Levites are a symbolic group for the community. They do not possess their own allotted land, a powerful reminder to every Israelite that the land doesn't belong to them, but to Yahweh. They're completely dependent on the generosity of others for their survival, like the mendicant monks. Again, a powerful symbolic statement that we're all dependent on Yahweh's generous blessing, and that everything we have is a gift. This total dependence is expressed by saying, chapter 18, verse 2, Yahweh is their inheritance. A reminder that this is true for all of Israel. It makes Israel special. So the Levites are a bit like contemplative orders, perhaps you might see. Or, in our system, an ordained priest who's focused only on that, reminds all of you that you're priests. You're all priests by baptism, you know. It should remind you of that. Traditionally, it often set the priest apart. We're lay people and he's a priest. That wasn't the point. The priest, nor was it with the... Oh, she's a Carmelite nun. You can't do that if you're married. Of course you can't. But the Carmelite nun can remind you to be contemplative, can't she? Or he? The priest can remind you that you're a priest. Prophet can remind you you're all supposed to speak God's word. And the king can remind you that you've all got a God job. We've all got a job to bring about the reign of God. So these hermit reminds you that you need a bit of time on your own. You need to be lonely at times. You need to make space for... Do you get me what I'm trying to get at? So these Levites were a powerful symbol of an aspect of everybody's life, but they did it professionally, you might say. And now lastly, regulation concerning the prophets. And this is the last page before we break. Deuteronomy 18, 9 to 22. Avoid those who claim magical power to foretell the future. Hello, hello, hello. When did you have your palm read? You're allowed to do it for fun, I think. I got my palm read once by somebody who was smart at it. And they told me, they didn't know who I was. They said, well, you're going to have 7 kids. I thought, God, I've left my run a bit late. Anyhow, so, oh, I suppose, I won't go down that track. But those who foretell, and you've got all these ways of people who are, instead of living in the present moment in trust, we're trying to control the future, which of course doesn't work, but people are. Here's the text. Of Yahweh your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your own people. You shall heed such a prophet. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their own people. I will put my words into the mouth of the prophet. He shall speak to them everything that I command. Claims to the prophet have to be tested, and they didn't have very good tests. We still don't have very good tests. The best test is given by Jesus, I think. You'll know them by their fruits. And sometimes, so if a person claims to be a prophet and he's making money out of it, don't take the slightest bit of notice. If he's claiming to be a prophet and he's mean, narrow, moralistic, controlling, certain of everything he says, take no note. Don't know what you're doing there listening even. Just walk out and buy a pie and sit in the park. Because if it is really a prophet, we will all be prophets, only to the extent that we are humble, listening, careful, uncertain when we're uncertain, distinguishing between our thoughts and God's thoughts, loving. Do you get me? They're the fruits. If they're not there, take no notice. If you've all gone by the time I come back in the second half, I'll know what you've done.